From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This week saw the 17th session of the Valdai Discussion Club, which met in Moscow. At the plenary session on Thursday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin discussed the goals of this year's meeting, whose theme was, quote, "the lessons of the pandemic and the new agenda, how to turn the world crisis into an opportunity for the world," close quote. This was Russia's President Vladimir Putin as he addressed the assembly on Thursday.
Let me welcome you to our traditional annual meetup. This time around, it takes place in an unusual format, through a video conference. I see some people in the hall of the Valdai Club, so still some people are present physically, and I think that the discussion was also taken shape. And yet we see that the epidemics of the coronavirus had a profound impact on the social, business, international life, but it didn't stop there. It changed the day-to-day life, the habits of people everywhere. Almost every country in the world has introduced some sort of enforced restrictions. Public events have been cancelled. Even for your club this year was a difficult one too, but the crucial thing is that you continue working through the use of the cutting-edge remote technology. You host fierce, insightful discussions. You debate. You introduce new experts that share their views. They voice out engaging, creative, often controversial and diametrically opposing views on the current developments. This debate is in much demand right now. It's very useful when there's no shortage of difficult issues that need to be answered. We are yet to wrap around our heads around the epidemic, its present and future impact for the humanity. But as we confront this peril, this challenge, the international community is trained to come together, and it managed to accomplish certain things together, but let me be frank with you, it accomplished far less than could have been done and should have been done in the face of such a colossal common challenge. And these squandered opportunities also invite genuine international discussion. Russia, from the start of the epidemics, focused on the core value, on life and safety of people, and this was a conscious choice. It was a choice stemmed by the culture, from the culture and spiritual traditions of our nation, from its complicated and often dramatic history. Just remember the huge demographic losses that we sustained in 20th century. We had no other way. We had to fight for the life of every man, for the future of every Russian family. And so we did just that. We tried to do everything to save health and lives of our citizens, to help parents and children alike, to help the elderly, those who lost their jobs, to keep the unemployment, to minimize the economic damage. We had to support millions of entrepreneurs who are in charge of small businesses or family businesses. You, just like everyone else, I think, keeping tabs on the daily data on the epidemics in the world. Coronavirus is not yielding and it's still a serious challenge. So I think this creates a background anxiety for many people. They start to think that it's a kind of a new era right now, that we're not just on the threshold of major changes, that this is a start of a new era of tectonic shifts across the domains of our life. We see the head-breaking pace of many processes that have been discussed in the Valdai Club sessions in the past. For instance, 6 years ago in 2014, the discussion was dubbed the world order, new rules or game without rules. So we've discussed this topic. So what now? Now, regrettably, the game without rules is really horrifying, but it's an accomplished fact right now. The pandemics has reminded us how fragile human life is. Could you imagine that in this technologically advanced 21st century, even in the most well-to-do, prosperous countries, population could have been rendered vulnerable and exposed to this ostensibly not that fatal infection, not that fatal threat. And yet life itself has shown us that it's not just about the accomplishments of the medical sciences with its fantastic accomplishments. Turned out that something else is even more relevant and important. It's the way the public healthcare is organized and whether it's accessible and available or not. The values of mutual help, duty, self-sacrifice, this is what unites people. Accountability, composure and integrity of the authorities, its readiness to appreciate the public demand and at the same time clearly and justifiably explain the rationale and the consequence of the adopted measures. In order to stop people from succumbing to fear, to not become estranged. And inspire confidence that whatever the difficulty, we'll stick it out together. The fight against coronavirus has shown that only a capable state can efficiently address the crisis. It runs counter to claims of those who the role of states in the global world globally is shrinking, of those who say that it will be giving way to some other shapes of social organization. It's true, everything changes, and it might happen at some point in future, but today we think that this is not the case. We have always believed that strong state is a basic enabler of the development of Russia. And we have seen this thesis to bear true once again. We've been painstakingly restoring and buttressing the state institutes after their decay and often total destruction in the 90s. Now, let me ask you, what is a strong state? What makes it strong? And granted, it's not about the total control or the law enforcement acting tough. It's not about ousting the private initiative or infringing upon civic initiatives. It's not even about the might of its military or defense potential, although I think you understand how important this component is, given its geography and the whole array of geopolitical challenges, given our historic responsibility as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. Responsibility to keep the global stability. And yet I'm convinced that the strength of the state is in the trust of its citizens, the trust that citizens put into it. Power comes from people. And it does not simply mean coming to a ballot box or casting a vote. It's all about the readiness to delegate a broad mandate to the elected officials. The ability to perceive the state, its bodies of state, its civil servants as their representatives, as those who are entrusted with decision-making, and also as those who can be held accountable for doing the duty properly. At the same time, the institutional framework can vary. It can take whichever shape. I mean, it doesn't matter how the political system is called. Each country has its own political culture and political traditions, their own views on how they should develop. Attempts to blindly copycat somebody else is pointless and harmless. It's crucial that the states and the society will live in harmony. And trust and confidence is the most reliable, the better foundation for productive work of the state. Only by working together we can strike an optimal balance of the freedom of actions and the security guarantees. And once again, during the darkest moments of the pandemic, I sensed pride, and I'm still proud of the Russian people. I'm proud of our citizens, of my fellow compatriots, of their readiness to work everything possible for one another. And primarily, I'm proud of our doctors, nurses, of our ambulance workers, for everyone who keep our healthcare going. I believe that the civil society will be a key enabler of Russia's development going forward, which is why we seek to make sure that the citizens, our citizens, have the final say, to make sure that meaningful contributions and popular demands from across the society will materialize. Naturally, it prompts a question. How does this happen? How does this popular demand take shape? Whose voice is the state supposed to hear? How do we understand if it's truly a popular vote, or is it just some backroom whispers, or even something irrelevant for our nation, some rowdy clamor bordering on hysteria? What we often see is how a bona fide popular demand is being substituted by an interest of some narrow social strata, or even foreign external powers. You know what? True democracy and civil society cannot be imported. I've mentioned this time and again. They cannot be a product of some do-gooders from abroad, even if they purportedly wish you well. Theoretically, this is probably possible, but let me be frank with you, I've never seen anything of the kind in my life, and I don't really believe in this. We all know, we've been through that. We know how this cargo called democracies function. This is but a hollow shell, a sham, devoid of any semblance of sovereignty. Nations actually have no say there. So, the quote-unquote heads of state are vassals whose fate is decided by the masters. So let me tell you once again, only citizens of the country are entitled to decide what their popular demand is. Russia has been through a long and winding road when basically the primary source of creating and funding the NGOs were some foreign foundations. Granted, not all of them had self-centered goals or malice aforethought, but some had a goal to throw the situation off balance, to interfere into our affairs, to weigh in on the Russian and internal and foreign policy, to lean it in their favor. Not all NGOs are like this. There are independent civil society groups, and probably there are genuine organizations wishing to help, and we are really grateful to them. But even in these instances, they were alien and extraneous bodies that reflected the views and interests of their foreign patrons, not the Russian citizens. Which is to say, they were tools in somebody else's hands, with all that it implies. Strong, free, independent civil society is by definition a nation-centered and a sovereign one. It has its origins in the grassroots level. It can have various shapes, but this is a product of the culture and traditions of a specific country. It's not a byproduct of some abstract transnational mind that is nothing but a screen for some foreign interests. A duty of a state is to support civil initiatives, to open up new opportunities for them, and this is exactly what we do. And I think that this issue must top the official agenda for decades to come, regardless of who holds which office. This is a key enabler of the sovereign and sustained development of Russia, its mainstay. It's the basis of genuine continuity as we move forward. It's the mainstay of our capacity and ability to rise to global challenges. Dear colleagues, you are well aware that controversies and pressing issues abound in international life. There was a moment when the stable, after a fashion, and the predictable model of the Cold War era existed. The situation changed since then. Don't take it as a sign of wistfulness for me. I'm not missing that era at all. But the world changed many times over since then. And the forces that were used to call political elites had no time, or maybe they were unwilling or unable to analyze. So what's exactly going on? Some countries hastened to slice up the pie, to reap the benefits that they gained after the cold standoff, quote unquote, has ended. Others rushed to adapt to the new world order, and still others, our country included, and we had a very dark experience. Indeed, we struggled to survive, to keep the country from breaking up, to keep agency in the international political affairs. At the same time, time persists in asking the question, what future has in stock for humanity? How the global order should look like, or what it's supposed to look like? Are we going to go forward meaningfully, or are we going to feel our way in the dark with nobody to rely upon but yourselves? The most recent report of the Valdai Club, your club, says, and I quote, the changed international environment shows that institutes are no longer the guarantee of global stability and governance. Rather, they impede the shaping of a system of relations that would be fit for the new era, end of quote. So the authors believe that we are about to see the world where certain states or groups of states will be acting more independently, while the traditional international organizations will slip into irrelevance. Well, let me say this. It's quite clear what is the rationale of this stance. In fact, the post-war global order was created by three winning powers: the Soviet Union, the United States, the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom's role has transformed ever since the USSR no longer exists, and Russia was marked by some as a non-starter. Let me be frank with you. We are assessing our capacities, intellectual, territorial, economic, and military capacities soberly. We are very clear-eyed about them. And our potential is something that we strengthen and make it more robust day in and day out. There are still forces who believe that Russia will just fade away and be no longer relevant. Well, their only concern is not to get cold at our burial ceremony. Well, I cannot agree that the current international structures should be disposed of. In fact, I believe that we need to maintain all the main instruments of the global security. I mean, the United Nations Security Council and the veto rights of its permanent members. I have recently mentioned this at the anniversary session of the General Assembly, and I believe that this stance, maintaining the basics of the post-Second World War order, has broad support in the world. Now, having said that, the very idea of readjusting the institutional layout of the global politics, I think, merits a discussion. For the sheer fact that the balance of power, just like I said, has changed dramatically, especially over the last 30 or 40 years. Yes, USSR no longer exists, but there is Russia in its place. Its, well, economic weight and political clout of China grants it the status of the superpower, and Germany is on the same trajectory. It becomes a greater actor in the international cooperation. At the same time, UK and France has seen a major transformation of their role. Even the United States at some point held sway globally, but now they can no longer make such a claim for exceptionality. And of course, the credibility and weight of such powers as India, Brazil, and South Africa has improved. It's true that not all international organizations are efficient at fulfilling their missions and mandates. They were meant to be impartial arbitrators, and yet they are driven by ideologies. They got captured by a gravity field of strong powers. They become a tool of those. Well, reshuffling rules of procedure, gerrymandering with privileges and mandates and bias, especially when it comes to conflicts implying the rivalry of powers or groups of states, is regrettably a common practice. And it is deploring when credible international organizations, motivated by someone's egotistic interests, getting dragged into politically driven campaign against certain leaders and countries. This practice discredits these institutes and leads to their decay. On the other hand, though, we have positive experience. We have examples of groups of stakeholder states coming together to address specific issues. For instance, a case in point would be a Shanghai Cooperation Organization that for almost two decades now has been helping to settle territorial disputes and reinforce stability in Central Asia. It creates a unique spirit of partnership in this part of the world. Or take Astana format. It helped to unlock the logjam of the political diplomatic process in Syria. It's worth remembering OPEC Plus. It's an efficient, although rather complicated, tool for stabilizing the global oil markets. The world is getting ever more fragmented, and such approach can prove more productive. What's crucial, though, it addresses specific problems and more. It can help to reinvent multilateral diplomacy itself, which is important. It's also obvious that we need a shared, universal, basic backbone structure of international affairs. Whichever groups, blocs, tactical alliances emerge now or going forward, we can't do without such a backbone structure. It is just that the multilateralism should be understood not as 100% inclusion, but rather a need to engage actors who are actually holding a stake in settling a problem. And granted, no good comes out of the following situation. Say, there is a process that implies certain groups of stakeholders that can actually come to terms with one another, and then third parties invite themselves shamelessly and brazenly with the only reason, with the only goal to showcase their ambitions, power, and influence, to carve out a niche for themselves, to con everybody out rather than make a meaningful contribution. Let me say this again. The international system right now is fragmented. It's often split into parts, it's splintered. But there are tasks that require more than just the potential of a certain state, even of influential states. Issues like international stability and security, countering terrorism, and addressing acute regional conflicts are one of those, as well as ensuring global economic development and fighting poverty. Expanding cooperation in healthcare. I think it's more than relevant today. I've mentioned all those issues in details about a month ago at the anniversary session of the General Assembly. In order to tackle these issues, we need to put together a systematic joint effort designed for the long run. However, there are even more further-reaching issues, something that every one of us has to deal with. I think many of us have read The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry and the childhood. There is a steadfast rule. You wake up in the morning, you wash yourself, you tidy up yourself, and then you tidy up your planet. It's a tedious job, all right, but not difficult at all. And I'm convinced that we have to be constantly engaged in this quote-unquote tedious work. If we want to save our shared home for the generations to come, we have to tidy up our planet. The issue of environmental protection is a staple item of the global agenda, but I would look at the bigger picture. We need to abandon the excessive, the unrestricted overconsumption and choose frugality instead, choose reasonable sufficiency. We should live not in the present, we should think about tomorrow. You often say that the nature is extremely vulnerable for human activity, especially as the natural resources are mined and exploited on the large scale globally. And yet, a man is still exposed to natural disasters. Many of them are caused by anthropogenic interference. Besides, many scientists think that outbreaks of dangerous diseases is a response to such an intrusion, and this is why it's crucial to build the harmonious relationship of man and nature. We see this on the example of climate change. This problem requires real action. It's no longer an abstract highbrow item for the scientific debate. It's something that has direct relevance for every citizen of Earth. Global warming makes the ice cap melt and makes the permafrost melt down. The experts believe that in the decades to come, the pace and intensity of such a process will only grow more intense. And this is a serious challenge for the rest of the world, and of course for Russia too, where permafrost takes up 65% of the territory. Such changes can deliver an irreparable damage to biodiversity. It can have an extremely negative impact on the economy and infrastructure. It can endanger people. This is a very relevant issue for us. It's true for pipeline systems under permafrost, for citizen settlements that are located on the Russian territory that stand on the permafrost. It is believed that by the year 2100, about 25% of the permafrost will thaw, will melt down, and this is a serious danger. The situation can spiral out of control. It's kind of a chain reaction. The meltdown of the permafrost causes the methane emission into atmosphere, and its greenhouse effect, just pay attention now, its greenhouse effect is 28% more harmful than the carbon dioxide. Consequently, the temperature on the planet will keep going up, permafrost will keep melting ever faster, ever more methane is emitted into the atmosphere. A vicious circle. After all, do we really want to live in a Venus climate with its lifeless and scorched surface? Average Earth surface temperature is 14 degrees Celsius. In Venus, it's 462. Let me go to something completely different now. Make no mistake. Planet Earth has more than just geographic continents right now. It has an almost infinite, almost boundless digital space, and year in and year out, people are exploring it ever faster. The enforced restrictions caused by the coronavirus epidemics have boosted the development of remote digital technology. So today, communications, internet-based communications, have become part of global commons, and we should seek to make this infrastructure, then cyberspace in its entirety, to operate seamlessly and securely. So the remote working arrangements are no longer a necessary precaution against the pandemics. In fact, we're talking about the new forms of employment, new forms of social interaction or human communication. As the technology progresses, these changes are inevitable.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.